Interview with Nelson Kibler, May 4th, 2009, in Fairfax, Virginia, by Kenneth Durr.
Well, I went to law school late in life.
Actually,
when I went to the commission, I had a junior college degree and I'd associate degree in accounting. And I went to the chief accountant's office. I had a CPA. You were able to sit for the CPA exam at that time with a two-year degree. And I had a CPA exam. I went to American University at night to get a bachelor's degree in accounting. And then much later on, I went to law school, which what is now George Mason School of Law.
So you got an accounting degree, you became a CPA, I guess, around 66 in there?
Yeah, that's about right, yeah. Okay. Yeah, I'm trying to remember the dates, but yeah, it's about 66.
Were you thinking of getting into the SEC, or how did that work? How did you come across that job?
when I was going, I always went to night school. I had a poor kid off farm up in Northern Virginia, and I started at Strayer Junior College at night, and I had a job during the day with a small regional brokerage firm here in Washington. It was then called Makeland Co., ultimately merged into Johnson Lemon and has now disappeared, but it's now part of Ferris Baker Watts. I was a cashier with the brokerage firm. So I had a brokerage background, and I was going to school at night, got my associate degree, did the CPA coaching school, ultimately got my CPA's, passed the CPA exam, what am I going to do? And then, well, I got the securities background, I'm interested, and I applied to the SEC. Once I got my CPA, I went to the district government as an internal auditor, D.C. government as an internal auditor. Did Lorton Reformatory, which was an interesting experience in its own right. and then applied for the SEC, and after my 2 years experience, and I applied, and Andrew Barr, who was the chief accountant at that time, hired me as a financial analyst, and ultimately I promoted to a staff accountant. Under the agreement that I would go get my bachelor's degree, and I went to American University at night. And I finally got my bachelor's degree, yeah.
Okay.
So I was with the chief accountant's office for a number of years before I went down to what is now Market Reg. It was Trading and Markets at that time.
Right. Tell me a little bit about Andy Barr and what his office was like.
Andrew Barr was an institution. I think he was the second chief accountant that the SEC had. He was from Illinois. He was an old bachelor. I made the mistake first week in the office of writing a memo and said Andrew C. Barr, and he called me in his office and said his family were Scotch and they couldn't afford middle initials, so so it was just Andrew Barr. He was a quintessential professional, a wonderful person to work for. He would give you work, check with you from time to time, and then expect you to come back and give you a lot of latitude to do things. It was always interesting to go to meetings with him, and I learned an awful lot when he had all the top people come into his office to discuss accounting issues, all the accounting firms, the major corporations. Everybody came to see him at that time, and he usually knew what the answer was before the people came in, but they never knew it. He would always let them talk. Usually they talked themselves into what he wanted them to do. He would rarely say no. They usually walked out feeling that they had a full and fair hearing, and it was a great experience to see him do that sort of stuff. And I learned a lot from that.
What kinds of issues was he dealing with?
Well, at that point, I don't think the AICPA was really in a force at that time. They didn't really have the accounting board or anything like that. He was basically the center of the accounting profession at that time. The state societies, and there was a national accounting association, but it wasn't nearly the board that we have now and that sort of stuff. So he was basically it in terms of the accounting, what the accounting was going to be for stuff.
So setting guidelines.
Setting guidelines, yeah.
So would he get down into the weeds with some of these accounting firms and say,
oh,
this
yes.
is how you're going to do this?
Yes, all the major accounting firms would come and visit him sometime, and he would go on the circuit. You know, he would go around and speak at all the state societies, to all the stuff like that. He was, as he put it, he had a message to deliver, and he would go around. The accounting firms would come visit him on accounting issues. I'm trying to remember exactly when the AICP CPA really started to set standards and stuff like that. They did, but it was really in conjunction with him. He was really the leading force for that.
He said he had a message. What was the message?
He was setting the standard for accounting in terms of what the accounting standards should be, reporting standards. And he spoke for the commission, and he was able to influence the accounting profession dramatically. Old Batchelor lived in the university club up in a one room at the university club up at in Washington. Bowled every weekend.
Was he the chief accountant for the whole time you were in that?
Yes, he was. when he retired. He retired, I guess, when Casey came. He retired, and then there was a reorganization. He retired. I left the chief accountant's office because they were setting up a new broker-dealer examination group in what was then Trading and Markets in Irv Pollack's division under a fellow by the name of Alex Brown, who had been the regional administrator for the Washington regional office.
Before we jump into that, tell me a little bit about the kind of work you did in the chief accountant.
Research, basically pull documents, pull financial statements, go through, review them. there would be an issue, we'd go try to find other examples, just like you do with find precedent in the law and stuff like that. You go look at other what other people are doing, try to put the stuff. The big thing, the biggest thing that happened during my time with his office was segment accounting. You know, segmented accounting was breaking down a conglomerate's reporting by business line.
Okay. And yeah, and there were a lot of conglomerates at that point. Right?
There were a lot of conglomerates, that's right.
Western was...
yeah, Textron, I think, Gulf and Western, Litton Industries, firms like that. I've forgotten half of them.
Right.
They've disappeared. But
so
yeah.
You were responding to the emergency.
That's right. he was, yes, at that time, right.
Was there a pushback?
Yeah, there was. ultimately, what happened is the accounting profession sponsored a study by a professor from the University of Illinois by the name of Mounts, I think, M-A-U-T-Z, I think it was, something like that. And he did a study, and ultimately the commission adopted rules that required segmented accounting. The chief accountant also at that time was involved in broker-dealer reporting and the capital requirements for broker-dealers.
Were you involved in that?
Yes.
Large part of your career later on.
Yes, it was. Yeah.
What was your involvement at this point in your
time? Oh, I was very junior. Well, actually, there were only about 8 people in the office, in his office. And he relied on his staff largely to, how would I say this accurately? He relied largely on the outside people. He organized people outside the commission to do studies, to do reviews, to do things. He was a master organizer in being able to get people to come together on these issues. And he was the, let's do this right fellows kind of person. And he had the stature, that is the stature of the commission's office as well as his own personal persona. He was able to motivate people to do what he thought was right.
So blue ribbon panels and that sort of thing.
That sort of thing, yes. Accounting firms would get together. He would organize panels. He would organize groups. He would say, "Here's a project. You know, get this done," and then stuff like that. And we would review things and we were basically advising the Division of Corporate Finance at that time as to what the accounting issues would come up, and he would basically decide it. He had a huge files that were indexed as to all the issues of accounting issues that have been resolved by the commission. And it was, you know, you go through the process of doing the research and applying it. So he did a couple of things. One, he would review, with the corporate finance, review reporting done by corporations as to whether they were conformed with the commission standards. He would consult with the profession, if you will, the outside profession, the accounting profession, in developing accounting standards. He was a wonderful person to work for.
So it sounds like a lot of this CorpFin was driving, sort of sending business your
way. CorpFin would send business our way. But he was also very active in the profession. I mean, tremendously active in the profession. Every maybe two or three times a month, he was out speaking somewhere.
Yeah, in the absence of an AICPA or whatever, there must.
Yeah, there was an accounting profession, but there was an accounting profession, but they were not the Accounting Financial Standards Board and stuff like that. You know, the FASB. There was nothing like FASB
right.
at that time,
right.
And it was. Nothing like that.
Well, wasn't it that it was mostly voluntary, and as long as it was really this voluntary organization, nobody could really get together because nobody was focusing on it?
Well, he was the center.
Yeah.
He was the one that, at least in my view, he was the one that made it work.
Right. Okay. That's interesting. So
he was succeeded by Sandy Burton, who was effective as well,
right.
Very effective.
Right. Yeah, I was wondering if you had actually worked.
I had not worked for him because when Mr. Barr left, retired, I went to what was then Trading and Markets to work to set up this new office for broker-dealer examinations.
Okay. What was your what was the SEC like back in the mid '60s?
Fraternal, collegial.
Yeah. I get the sense that it was pretty different back in those.
I think so. I'll say this, and I don't mean this pejoratively, it's not, but there was a split. Most of the senior staff at the commission at the time I was there had come there after World War II. Mm-hmm. They'd come right out of the Army and all that sort of stuff. And they had been long-term government professionals. In the best sense of the word, it just as I was coming, and a few years later, particularly after Casey came, you started to see a much younger group of people, and those people starting to retire. There was a major turnover around the time that Casey came. Even then, it was a very very collegial, tight knit, fraternal group of people. Everybody knew everybody, it seemed. Not a lot of turnover. Even then, you were able to get the best law school, you know, the best kids out of law school and stuff like that. And they come looking for a career. And
would you run into work with people besides corporate trading markets, for example?
I worked a lot with Trading and Markets because of the investigations. Yeah. Yeah, Trading and Markets, the investment company. I forgot where investment companies were at that time. There was no separate division for it. I think it was in Trading and Markets. I've forgotten exactly where investment companies were lodged at that time.
Well, tell me a little bit about the opportunity to shift over then. Was this in response to the back office crisis?
It's just before that. It was just before that. Casey became chairman, and there were three study groups, as I recall, and the one I was most particularly concerned with was the financial reporting for broker-dealers. As a matter of fact, I was staff support for that, and worked on that, and that's where we came up with uniform reporting for broker-dealers.
Why did he create the study group?
This was Casey. Casey was reforming the commission. He basically split up trading and markets into market reg and enforcement. I think the issue was philosophic that the people who were regulating shouldn't be investigating or prosecuting, if you will. Irv Pollack was the director of trading and markets at the time, and Stan was his principal lieutenant, as I recall. Shelley Rappaport was there. There was a close group in trading and markets, and Casey broke them up.
And now these three groups, these three study groups, that was to help figure out how to put them.
Well, I think part of it was to deal with corporate finance. Part of it was to deal with broker dealers. And I, frankly, honestly, I have to go back and look. I forgot what the third group was. We all produced reports. It was an outside group. The chairman of my group was a fellow by the name of Stepanek out of William Baird out of Milwaukee, I believe it was. And we had Eli Weinberg, who was with, I think, White Weld at the time. And I've forgotten who the other, Cunningham, I think, from the New York Stock Exchange. And I forgot, there were a couple of other people like that on the committee. And we came up with a report on broker-dealer reporting and that sort of stuff.
Okay.
And it was relatively well received.
Well, the back office crisis hit late 60s, early 70s.
That's exactly right.
You must have been looking at some of the fallout from that.
With all due respect to the current crisis, that was as dramatic, I think, as this. The only difference being that broker-dealers were not as prominent in the national economy as banks are today since Glass-Steagall was gone. We lost, I think there were 60 members of the New York Stock Exchange that are gone. We did the unsafe and unsound study. You're not aware of that?
No, I haven't heard that name. So give me a little bit of background on the unsafe and unsound.
Congress authorized us to conduct a study on unsafe and unsound practices of broker-dealers in the 60s to as a result of the paperwork crisis. And it was a couple hundred page report. It was comparable to the study that was done in the early 40s with respect to what was the study that was so important back in the 40s or 50s?
It was a special study.
Special study. The old special study. Yeah. It's comparable to that in its scope.
Were you involved in that?
Yes, very much. Deeply involved in that.
Who was this? People from all through the commission that came together.
It was largely. I'm trying to remember all the players that were involved in it. I have a copy of the report at home, and it's online. And everybody who was involved in it was stuff. But it was largely. Either trading in markets or just at the end of it was either just at the end of trading in markets or part of done by part of trading in markets or just part of or early part of market rake. I think it was done in trading in markets. And We did an inspection of the New York Stock Exchange, mm-hmm. And other exchanges. At the time, there were the New York Stock Exchange, American Stock Exchange, Philadelphia, Baltimore, Washington Exchange, Boston, Chicago, Kansas City, Pacific Stock Exchange, both floors, the Spokane Stock Exchange.
Were they happy to see you coming?
The New York Stock Exchange. This study, the Unsafe and Unsound Practices, was in response to the very difficult time that the broker dealers were having in New York, and mostly under the supervision of the New York Stock Exchange. And the report focused largely on the regulatory supervision by the New York Stock Exchange, and we did an examination, you would call investigation perhaps, and were critical of the New York Stock Exchange, and it required them to come to a commission and defend themselves a lot. And there's a fellow by the name of Bob Bishop there, and he used to come often and was eloquent and bitter about the whole process. A very effective guy for the exchange. But the result was a seminal, sea change in the way the regulatory system worked for broker dealers. And that's really where that report study we did came in.
Got a 69 study of New York Stock Exchange firms.
Yeah, that's another one. That was another one. Yeah, there were two at the time. That's another one. Those programs were run by lawyers out of what was then, I think, Trading and Markets.
Okay. Yeah. And what was the sea change?
Well, first of all, there was the exchanges were relieved of their ability to directly regulate their. I'll do it another way. For example, the capital requirements for broker dealers at that time was fragmented. Each exchange had their own capital requirements, and the NASD applied ours. That is, the New York Stock. The only capital rule that was opposed by the SEC was the one that were NASD members only. So we adopted a uniform net capital rule that applied to all broker-dealers. Okay. And basically took the authority of the exchanges away to interpret them. So we did the interpretation, we did the enforcement, we reviewed the exchanges to see that they were enforcing the rules and all that sort of stuff. The second thing is that each of the exchanges had their own reporting system for their members. The New York Stock Exchange, we had one meeting where Bishop came in and all the exchanges were in, and Bishop came in and we were anxious to have them share information from their reports. And Bishop said, no, New York Stock Exchange member, regulated by the New York Stock Exchange, they weren't going to share anything. So eventually they lost that ability. We adopted a uniform financial reporting system that came to the commission and reviewed by the commission. Also at that time, one of the major problems that happened was that in the paperwork crisis, brokers were having difficulty getting financing. And so what they would do is they would try to roll over each day a broker-dealer settles these transactions. And when the securities that have been purchased by customers would come in, the broker-dealer would pay for them. But at the same time, the broker would be selling customer securities, so he would have obligation to deliver securities to the street. So they just roll it around and put it back out because they needed the money. They weren't allocating the securities that had been purchased and paid for to customers. So that was a major, major problem, and it ultimately took down the New York Stock Exchange had a building fund, I think $25-30 million that they were going to put a new building down on Wall Street, down on Wharf. So they took that money and basically bailed out a number of broker dealers, customers, you know, paid off customers to do it. That was the impetus for SIPC. It was basically that they didn't have enough money, and DuPont and some of the other firms went out and they took the whole building fund.
Net capital rules are really important here, clearly. And my understanding is that the SEC had something. They had
in 1940, the NASD proposed a capital rule that would be applicable to all broker dealers, and the SEC said no. Some of the exchange rules are more stringent than that, so they denied the NASD, and then they went ahead and adopted the NASD. The SEC adopted the NASD's capital rule itself, and then left the various exchanges to enforce their own capital rules.
What was the difference between the SEC, the one that the SEC adopted, and the New York Stock Exchange's rule?
The 40 rule,
yeah.
The 1940 rule, the
I've
one.
I've got 15C31.
Yeah, 15C31 is the rule that it has gone through several iterations. The first iteration was the rule that they adopted in 1940.
Uh-huh.
Then in 72, I think I got the date right, they adopted the uniform net capital rule that was applicable to all broker dealers. That was much more comprehensive than the 40 rule, much more comprehensive. But you had a relatively uncomplicated business back in the 40 compared to what it was in 72, much less compared to what it is now. But the rule that was ultimately adopted was the New York Stock Exchange rule plus additional things. But equally important was the customer protection rule, which addressed the other issue I was talking about, where broker dealers would bring the securities in, pay for them, roll them out again, and not lock them up for the benefit of customers, which was another rule we adopted, which is 15C3-3.
Okay.
About the same time.
Now, did all of this come out of that group that you joined when you went into trading and markets?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. It all came out of that and iterations of it. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Who were you working with?
Well, when the office was first set up, a gentleman by the name of Alex Brown, a longtime commission employee out of Chicago, regional administrator of the Washington regional office, he was there for, we set up the office, started to go around to review the examination programs of the various exchanges, stuff like that. Looked at reports, that sort of thing. Then this sort of stuff, the paperwork crisis started to evolve. He left, and as Casey came in, the people I worked with primarily were was a fellow by the name of Lee Picard.
He would have been an associate director of trading.
He became associate director. He was an assistant director of market regulation,
right?
Ultimately, came the director of the division.
Right.
A fellow by the name of Bruce Hurd, I think his name was, had a sort of notorious career at the commission. He did the examination of the New York Stock Exchange, and then wrote a book called "Unsafe and Unsound Practices."
Is that why he was notorious?
Well, he didn't last long after that. He'd gone to Casey and asked him, Casey, if he could write the book, and Casey said, sure, after he wrote the book and got the securities industry all furious. He didn't last very long under Casey.
Casey ended up not liking the book being out there, I guess.
originally he supported it, but when it got so much heat, he told Hurd to leave, so Hurd left.
Yeah.
And it's called Unsafe and Unsound Practices of Broker Dealers.
I got to get a copy of that.
It's probably not in print anymore. I think I got it somewhere.
New York Stock Exchange had a lot of leverage at that point, I guess, over the commission.
They lost a lot during that period. They lost tremendous leverage, and they lost a lot of authority because of the crisis. Whereas before, the commission left them alone. After that, they couldn't do anything without the commission's oversight. Lost a tremendous leverage. So what came out of that was the focus report, the uniform reporting system for all broker-dealers, the uniform net capital rule, the customer protection rule, Rule 15C3-3. We also audits we got involved in the accounting profession too, and we asked the auditors to report any material inadequacies in the of broker dealers, and that was a major fight. They didn't think they should do that, but we adopted the rule, and so now they report as to whether there's any material deficiencies in handling customer funds and securities or compliance with the capital rules, stuff like that.
Did the commission see a change after that? Did they start reporting these things?
Yes, they started reporting. Yes, we did get reports. Yes, we did. We did. I just have to reflect a minute on on that. That was a major fight with the accounting profession. They really didn't want to do that.
Why not?
Well. Under GAAP, under generally accepted accounting principles, they were reporting on the compliance. They were going to report on compliance, whether the financial statements complied with GAAP.
Right.
This was a special purpose, and our point, of course, was that the focus report was not a general purpose financial statement; that it was a special purpose report to report the financial condition to the commission for regulatory purposes to determine whether the firm is in compliance with their capital and that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. So it was not a general purpose report. It was a special report. If they wanted to do audits of broker dealers, they were going to have to do a special purpose report.
Did you call that a focus report?
Yeah, financial and uniform operational FOCUS, financial operation uniform combined report.
Okay, great. Okay, so
also another player at that time was Dan Polaro. Casey brought a group of people with him. Casey had been a major player in the Nixon election campaign, and he brought a number of people with him. Picard was one, Polaro was one. There were some others, I've forgotten who, but they came to the commission at that time.
Okay.
There was tremendous tension between enforcement and market regulation at that time over this kind of stuff. I mean, there was tremendous tension between.
Did market regulation want to sort of cooperate more than
well,
enforcement?
Well, part of it was personality, part of it was professional, I think. Irv and his group in enforcement didn't trust market reg, didn't trust the new people who were coming in. Didn't trust Casey.
But of course, Casey's the chairman, so.
Yes, but there was tremendous tension.
Yeah, and you must have seen that. You would have been.
I was in a very difficult position. I was in a very difficult position because I had worked for Irv in trading and markets. I thought he was a wonderful leader. I mean, he was a tremendous leader, someone to work for. Particularly Polaro had been a political operative and was a notoriously difficult person to work with. And there was tremendous distrust between enforcement in our office at that time because of these, because of this. And people didn't trust Polaro at all in enforcement. Mm-hmm.
That he wasn't interested really in doing a serious job of regulating?
No. Well, I don't know about that. Dan was sort of amoral in the sense that you never knew where he stood. He was a difficult person to work for because in his office he'd divide people up and one on one. You know, you work one on one with him. Very difficult time. And there was about 2 years there where it was a very delicate sort of high in between or trying to moderate between the difficult things. At that time, just to illustrate the tensions at that time, Picard was the director of the division, and Polaro was my boss. He was an associate director, I believe. I was an assistant director at the time. It was the time that the Chicago Board Options Exchange was just beginning. And Joe Sullivan, who was president, was coming in and trying to get the exchange organized. And ultimately, the commission let them do it. And much to, I think Sporkin was then the director of the Division of Enforcement, and it's not something that he wanted to see. He had a famous quote about, you know, I'll get to that in a minute. But they had a hearing. Shell Rapport was the hearing officer. All the exchanges supported it. So they were approved to do it. So we had our office, Polaro, had the responsibility of what are the capital requirements going to be for the floor participants, people on the floor who are going to register, going to do the trading on the floor. And the Chicago Board Options Exchange at that time, what they were doing, they had a number of players who were over on the commodity side. You know, this is a subsidiary of the Board of Trade. And so they had a lot of floor brokers from the operators from the Board of Trade who had a seat on the Chicago Board Options Exchange, and they were going to support the traders there. You know, they're going to do the trading. So no one had any clue as to how to trade options, listed options. So they didn't recruit from the floor of the options exchange, the commodities exchange. They recruited people off the street and basically trained them to be traders on the floor. So these guys came in and they had no capital and no experience, but they would go through a training session and give them money to trade and explain to them how to, you know, they'd let them do certain types of trades until they got more experience. They'd give them more money and let them do more different types of trades. So our mission was, Polaro and I, was to devise capital requirements for these floor traders and the brokers who hired them, who they were working for. So one time we went out to see Sullivan in Chicago, and off, more or less off the cuff, we're standing by this on the sidewalk getting in a cab, going down, and Polaro says, well, what are we going to tell them? And I said, well, why don't we say, you know, the brokers who are supporting these four traders, if they're going to support them, why don't they take the capital, capital charges for the exposure that these guys have, you know, and their capital requirements, stuff like that. We sort of set up off the cuff sort of a system that would basically, the brokers who were carrying these traders would take capital hits based on their positions. This was off the cuff, standing on the sidewalk before we go down to Chicago.
Common sense kind of thing.
I gotta go on. So we get down and we talk to Sullivan, and okay, we'll do that, because he wants to get this thing going. So we come back to Washington, and we propose this scheme, this plan. And we get a lot of support for it, except from enforcement. Because Stan was looking at the traders on the floor, pimps, hairdressers, taxi cab drivers, and I forgot what else terms he used, but he was not impressed with it. And he really didn't like, at least in my understanding at the time, he was not very happy with the options trading. So we go to a commission meeting where this is going to be discussed. You know, we've got a proposal, we're going to do it. And Picard was there. Tony Snodgrass, who was chief counsel for the division at that time, Polaro and I. And of course, Stan is over here on the other side with Chicago Regional Office and sort of people. And they oppose this on the basis that they would be extending unsecured credit, which is illegal under Reg T. So there is a verbal debate, I'll put it mildly, before the commission over this. At one point, Snodgrass says to Sporkin, if you want to know what the rule says, why don't you ask the guy who put pen to paper? Tell him, Nelson.
Did you tell him?
I said, mea culpa, but... Well, anyway, yeah, we went through it, and the commission disapproved it. And all hell broke loose. All the exchanges who were going to do this asked for a meeting with the commission. We had a... Actually, Irv Pollack was still director of the division at that time. Sporkin was the chief guy on this, but he was still director. So the exchanges all came in with their counsel, and they had a meeting before the commission to discuss this, and it was and then they had their say, and the commission sent them out of the room, and then we had a further discussion. Ultimately, the commission approved it.
Hmm. Was the idea that instead of the broker dealers, the traders themselves should have had the capital?
No. I think Stan's objection was an objection to the whole principle. Okay. The concept is still there. It still works. I mean, it's worked fine over the years. It stood the test of time.
It seemed like you spent a lot of time working out net capital rules in various places and areas. And the first one was just for broker dealers in general after the back office crisis, right?
Oh, after the back crisis, I became assistant director. Polaro moved on. Lee moved on, Picard moved on. The new director, I think, was Doug Scarf, as I recall. And his general counsel was still Snodgrass. No, I think Snodgrass had left. His general counsel, I think, was... I've forgotten who his general counsel was. but the next crisis, when I was with Doug, was the silver crisis with the Hunts.
Oh, okay, in the late 70s, early 1980s, something like that.
Let's see. The paperwork crisis was the first issue, and that was dramatic. The second issue was there was a credit crunch in the securities industry. They couldn't get funding. Then came the Hunts with the silver. That was interesting, too.
Well, go ahead and tell me about that, since you brought it up. I know the Hunt thing
Hunt's
blew
quarter,
up
Hunt's,
around 1980.
The Hunts cornered the silver market.
Right.
And it became a national event. At one point, I think the Fed and the Treasury and the SEC and I don't know who all else had a major meeting over it and all that sort of stuff. And I'm getting confused now. I have to sort it out. And then the Commodities Futures Trading Commission was around at that time. They were involved in it as well. And actually it was Bache, I think, who had the major exposure there. And we had to work our way through that crisis, but that went away. I've forgotten exactly how it was resolved, whether the Treasury bought it or whether it simply the market simply went away and evaporated. There was also a major crisis when they allowed gold to be traded, let people own gold, and we went through a whole exercise of revising the segregation rules. And when the first trade took place, nothing ever happened. It didn't event, no, not event.
I guess that's a good thing.
I guess that was a good thing.
75, you moved up through, you were a broker-dealer financial regulatory officer.
Yeah, that's about the time. Then when Polaro left, I became assistant director. That's
assistant
how it worked.
Director of financial responsibility.
Right.
Title.
Yeah. What did that mean?
Yeah, tell me about what that title was about.
It was 15C33, 15C31, the net capital rule, financial reporting, Reg T to the extent that the commission had a role in that, coordination with SIPC in liquidating broker-dealers, and a coordination of the commission's examination program, oversight of the exchange's regular examination programs.
Okay.
A lot of fun.
Which did the examination program consume a lot of your energy?
Not so much because we had the regional offices were very effective. We would have periodic get-togethers, coordination, all that sort of stuff. Actually, Polaro did a very good job at that. He instituted a program of having regular meetings, bring those people in, getting them before the commission in a sense because they had been in the backwater, and he basically gave them a lot more importance, which was a good thing. And improved their morale and effectiveness tremendously.
So you must have seen a pretty big difference then, say, from 1970 to 1975.
Yeah, prior to in the 60s, the commission's examination program was in New York, and it wasn't. It was a one-man show, if you will.
Do you remember who the man was?
I do. I can't remember his name, obviously, now. And it was like one or two people. But he was an old-timer, and he wore spats. And I cannot remember his name.
Wow. And then going into 75 is the date that I have for the uniform net capital rule.
That's right.
That's
about right, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's about right, yeah.
And this is about the time, a lot happened in 75, right?
Oh, yeah.
The congressional legislation that revises the whole act entirely.
Well, there were changes to the act, that's true, yes.
I'm wondering about that the net capital rule, did that have any relationship, this uniform net capital rule, did that have any relationship to all these other changes that were going on at that time?
Well, as we said a little earlier, this was a seminal time for broker-dealer regulation. I mean, everything changed at that point in time. Everything from capital compliance, handling of customer funds and securities, to audits, to reporting, to and SIPC became a factor. Everything changed at that time. The whole regulatory scheme changed.
Did the 75 acts act?
You know, I've forgotten exactly what happened with the act. I've forgotten how that affected us. That may have given us some authority that we didn't have before, but I have honestly forgotten what that was.
Okay. talked a little bit about, actually there was a study, 76, 77, a deliberate study on net capital for options markets. Is that the time period that you were talking about before?
Yes. Well, I've forgotten. That could have been. No, that was different. We're getting into time now when Black-Scholes became important. Black-Scholes provided a trading model for people who were particularly on the floor, for them to price options and trade them. And a lot of different strategies started to evolve, straps, straddles, hedges, all kinds of things, being able to put together risk-limiting strategies and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And we didn't have anything to deal with it, so it was a major task to try to put together. Try to, one, understand the strategies, and two, to put together a capital program for it. That's schedule. What is that? That's appendix. Appendix. One of the appendixes to the capital. I think it's B or C. I've forgotten which one. C, I think.
Did you go to Chicago and camp out and watch what people were doing? How did you do this?
I remember going to Chicago one time, and one of the members of the Chicago Board Options Exchange, who was a major player on the floor. He didn't trade on the floor, but he had a broker dealer who had all these traders on the floor. And but he was a commodities trader, and he took me over to the Board of Trade, and I forget what pit we were on, this nice, wonderful, mild-mannered guy goes. He said, "I'm going over here. You stand here." I was in the pit on the side. He said, "You stand here. Keep your hands in your pockets," just and stuff like that. So the bell opened, and this mild-mannered man went crazy. It was just amazing. Just amazing to see what happened. Transformation happened to him. I went to Silver Pit when Silver was. Stuff like that, and I thought they were going to call the cops. I thought it was a riot.
Wow. So did they tell you to keep your hands in your pockets so you wouldn't buy anything by accident?
No, I think it's just so it wouldn't just be a distraction for more than anything else.
But you did this study then?
Yeah, we did a study. We actually a study, like most commission studies are done. It's done largely with the cooperation of the brokers involved.
Right.
And you're more. One, you're at a tremendous disadvantage because if you don't do this stuff every day, it's very hard to do it, hard to catch up with it, hard to understand it. So you rely upon the experts, the people who are doing this, to put together, and then you review it and try to understand it and try to get it, try to make sure that it provides customer protection, the customer protection that would be appropriate.
Right. So did you, and then did a new rule follow that study?
Yeah, there was an amendment to the net capital rule. It's one of the appendices, and I forgot which one it is. It's A, B, C, and D, and I forgot whether it's A, B, C, or D. D is the subordination agreement. A, I think, is consolidation. It's one of those. And
You would think that the options traders or the brokers or whatever would have...
See, if it were just on the floor, if it were just the floor traders, yeah. We didn't have a problem because they were covered by the capital requirements that governed the people who employed them.
Right.
That was not the issue. The issue was where it was being traded by arbitrage guys at broker-dealers as part of their broker-dealer business. Off the floor, if you will.
Okay. And was this
the Merrill Lynch has now started to do this sort of stuff. They started to have desks.
People Merrill Lynch.
You know, those kinds.
Yeah.
As opposed to the major wirehouses and so forth. Yeah.
Right. they'd sort of sat back and waited for options to become viable, I guess? Or?
Well, once Black-Scholes was adopted, you know, once the professors came forward and had a model for pricing,
right.
you had a more rational basis for doing trading.
Okay, that makes sense. So then the big guys come in.
And then we had to deal with requirements. And of course, the New York Stock Exchange is a major player too, because, and the Board of Trade, CBOE and stuff.
Okay. Now, in 82, then the market rate was sort of rearranged again, and you went into.
Actually, 82, I'm leaving, I think.
Okay. Yeah, I have what's it called? Joint Inspections Office.
Oh, that's right. That came after I left. Okay. Yeah, that came after I left.
Well, tell me a little bit about the decision to leave.
I expected to be a commission employee, and I enjoyed it. It was exciting, interesting, and rewarding place to work. I liked the people. I liked the work. It was exciting to have to be able to be involved in important things and have an impact. And I enjoyed it, liked it, so I thought I'd stay. But Touche Ross at that time did not have a broker-dealer audit practice, but they through acquisition of two of their clients, Prudential and Sears, acquired Dean Witter and Beige. Dean Witter and I guess it was Beige? I've forgotten which firm was. So they now had a practice, and they had decided as a strategy that they were going to focus on the financial services industry and put together, since they had a core business, they were going to try to build a practice around that in the financial services area, banking, investment companies, broker dealers. And so they started to recruit people to build that practice. They approached me at the commission as to whether I would come and join. And it was a great opportunity, and I did.
Okay. This would have also been just about the time that John Shad's coming in, too.
Exactly. Shad had nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
But I wasn't a big fan of Shad, but...
I guess I wondered if you saw the commission changing at all, or...
Well, the commission had changed... I think the commission changed more after I left than then. I think it was largely still a collegial, and I don't say it's not collegial now, but we were able. It was still a relatively smaller than it is now, and the commission was able to attract the best kids out of law school and stuff like that, the top of their class, top 5 or 10%. They would come work 10 hours a day, 7 days a week, get their so-called graduate degree in securities law, and then go to Sullivan Cromwell or, you know, Wookie Farr or wherever,
right.
and work in a high-profile securities practice. And it was a great place because you got wonderful people there. I don't know that they get the same kind of group of people now. I just can't tell.
Yeah.
But it just, the commission does seem different now. It may seems more. They got a union in corp. Hey, they got a union now, which is unheard of in those days. I just don't know that you have the same kind of esprit de corps that we had when we were there.
One other thing. Oh, before we, did you have any involvement in working with municipal securities?
Municipal securities in the board?
Yeah.
Municipal securities? Very little. I think that may have happened after I came.
Okay.
The big change was in the industry, though, because the industry went, when I started the commission in the late 60s, the securities industry was not regional. It was largely New York and regional firms, but it was not national. You had partnerships where people had stakes in the business, partners, and that was a major problem in the paperwork crisis. Then later on, Donaldson Gen-Rat went public. And now you had public money, and Merrill Lynch went public, and now you have raising money with the public. And they're now national, and ultimately, whereas Glass-Steagall kept them apart, now they're part of banks. The banks seem to be taking over the industry now.
Well, one other thing that I thought was interesting from a securities point of view is that you had some kind of role when E.F. Hutton got stuck with their check
kite. That was after I left the commission. That's right. They were found guilty of a felony, actually several thousand felonies, using the float of innocent banks without their permission, if you will. And as a result of their pleading guilty to a felony, they were statutorily barred from being a registered broker-dealer. Being an investment advisor, I guess is what it was, investment advisor.
Right.
So the commission decided, rather than pull their ticket, that they would someone do a examination of them to see whether they were kiting customers, whether they were as aggressive using customers' money as they were other banks' monies. Mm-hmm. And I was appointed as a independent consultant, the first one, as a matter of fact, to do a study for the commission on whether they were complying with 3.3.
You were the first independent consultant that mm-hmm. they mm-hmm. chose for something like this? Okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What did you find out?
They were not. The report was an important one in the sense that it was terribly expensive for E.F. Hutton. But they were complying with the rule, with the rules, and it was very interesting. We went through the banking system stuff. It was a long report. I've got the report someplace. I forgot what I've done with it. But the report was filed with the commission. It was a long one, and basically said what we did and that we didn't find any violation of 3.3.
Now, were you working as within Touche Ross when you were doing this, or was this?
Yeah, I was. I'd left the commission maybe a year or 2 years. E.F. Hutton approached me to be their independent consultant. They proposed me, and the commission didn't object. The conditions were that I would hire counsel, since, you know, an outside counsel, which was a problem because I couldn't find anybody who didn't have a conflict, except for Jim Treadway, who was a former commissioner who had just left the commission and joined Baker Botts in their brand new Washington office. So I engaged him and Baker Botts to be my counsel.
Okay. And now this is something that you've done
several times.
Other occasions.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Several times, yeah.
Is
mm-hmm.
this pretty much a common practice at this point?
At this point, yeah. Recently they've had a lot of independent consultants to do reviews with respect to mutual fund sales and stuff like that. A lot of them recently, and it's a fairly common practice now.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, right now I'm a independent distribution consultant. They brought action against a broker dealer for not disclosing that they had taken money from mutual fund groups to distribute their funds without disclosing to the customers who bought them that they were taking money from the funds. So they had to give back 30 some odd million dollars, and we're in the process of giving back. I'm the independent consultant giving back $31 million to a bunch of people.
Well, that must be nice.
You know, it's been 4 years. It's taken 4 years
yeah.
to get it done.
Yeah.
And the major part of it was getting the plan approved by the commission. And now we started to give the money out in December when the market broke. And since then sums of money are relatively modest when you divide it over 700,000 people. You send a $25 check to someone and they've lost $100,000 if they're offended. Don't want to and send it back to you.
Yeah, kind of takes the gratification away from the job. You've actually had people return your check?
Yeah.
Wow. Well, so it sounds like
along with a nasty letter.
Sounds like this work with E.F. Hutton kind of set a pattern.
Yeah, the commission has done that, has used that quite a bit since then, yes.
Well, is there anything that we haven't talked about that springs to mind that we should cover before we wrap up?
There's 1,000 stories, but I couldn't remember all of them. Yeah, wonderful people. I had a great time.
All right. Well, terrific. Thanks.
Okay.